The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome to the deep dive. Look, if you thought you knew the basic story of the Americas before Columbus, well, maybe prepare to have your mind blown a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
We are diving into Charles C. Mann's really, really important book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus.
And it's such a critical book because, you know, for centuries we've had this picture painted for us, right? Columbus arrives, finds a new world, maybe some scattered tribes in a vast untouched wilderness.
Right, the classic textbook image.
Exactly. And Mann just takes that image and says, hold on, that's fundamentally wrong.
He doesn't just question it. It feels like he completely flips the narrative.
Yeah.
The old story is empty wilderness. Mann's story is... it's about encountering a civilization reeling from an unseen catastrophe. That's the core of it. He calls it a recently widowed land. The whole point of the book, really, is to take apart this pristine myth, this romantic idea that America was just empty natural space before Europeans.
And that's not just like an academic quibble, is it?
Oh, not at all.
Yeah.
Understanding this massive population collapse before most Europeans even arrived, has huge implications today for how we think about the environment, conservation, indigenous rights, our whole understanding of history.
Widowed land. That phrase really sticks with you. Okay, so who is Charles Mann? He's not like a specialized archaeologist digging up ruins, right? He's a science journalist.
Yeah.
How does that background shape this kind of history rewriting book?
Well, I think that's actually his strength here. He writes for places like The Atlantic, Science, Wired. He spent years doing what academics in one narrow field often can, synthesis. He went out and talked to everybody.
Uh-huh.
Archaeologists, sure, but also geneticists, epidemiologists, soil scientists, anthropologists. Pulling together research from all these different silos.
So his contribution isn't finding one specific new bone or pot fragment. It's seeing how all these disparate pieces of evidence, you know, the ancient pollen sample over here, the genetic data over there, the soil analysis, how they actually paint this much bigger, frankly, much darker picture.
Precisely. He's like a master connector of dots.
Right.
He can step back and see the pattern that specialists, maybe too focused on their own corner, might miss. And because he's a journalist, he approaches controversial stuff like, say, pre-contact population numbers with a certain objectivity. He weighs the evidence without necessarily having an institutional dog in the fight.
Right. And he followed this up with 1493, looking at the global ecological impact after Columbus, cementing his role as a big history guy.
Absolutely. He's brilliant at telling these huge interconnected stories.
Okay, let's nail down the central argument of 1491. If the Americas weren't this empty wilderness, what does Mann say they actually were? What's the big takeaway?
The big takeaway is that the Americas, before Columbus, were home to ancient, incredibly large, and highly sophisticated civilizations. These weren't just hunter-gatherers wandering around. We're talking complex societies, cities, empires.
Wow.
And people who had been actively shaping and engineering their environments for literally thousands of years. The populations were huge, and their achievements in agriculture, engineering, mathematics, astronomy rivaled or even surpassed what was happening in Europe or Asia at the time.
That's a massive shift from the picture most of us have.
Yeah.
But okay, if it was so populated and developed, why did it look so empty and wild to the Europeans who arrived later, say in the 1600s?
That's the crux of it. They were arriving after the catastrophe. The core argument, the engine driving the whole book, is disease. European diseases, smallpox, measles, influenza, things Native Americans had zero immunity to. They traveled ahead of the colonists.
Ahead of them. How?
Through existing indigenous trade networks. These diseases rip through the continents, causing what Mann calls the Great Dying. We're talking maybe 95% of the population wiped out in some areas before systematic European settlement and documentation really began.
So a European explorer lands, sees forests, maybe some open fields, very few people, and just assumes, untouched wilderness.
Exactly. They're looking at a post-apocalyptic landscape, the result of this enormous invisible biological wave, and they mistake the aftermath for the original condition.
And that fundamental misunderstanding.
That's what Mann labels Holmberg's mistake, based on an anthropologist who made a similar error studying a devastated group in Bolivia much later. The book marshals evidence from all over Mesoamerica, the Andes, North America, to show just how profoundly humanized this landscape was before it all came crashing down.
Let's dive into that crash then. The scale of it. You mentioned population numbers. Mann sides with the high counters, right? Suggesting really massive pre-contact populations.
He does. The evidence he presents strongly supports figures far, far higher than older estimates. We could be talking 50, 70, maybe even 100 million people across North and South America. That's a significant portion of the entire global population at the time.
That just reframes everything. And the horror of the Great Dying wasn't just the numbers, but the speed, right? These virgin soil epidemics.
Yeah, zero prior exposure meant zero immunity. The diseases didn't just kill individuals, they shattered societies. Imagine losing 9 out of 10 people in your community within a generation or less. Political structures collapse, knowledge is lost, farming systems fail, the environment changes. It's total systemic breakdown.
It's almost unimaginable. But how could disease really travel faster than the people carrying it?
Think about existing trade routes. Extensive networks connected communities across vast distances. A disease introduced perhaps by shipwrecked sailors or early coastal contact could spread inland along these routes, like wildfire, decimating populations long before a European army or settler group ever showed up there.
Wow, so the people writing the first detailed accounts were often describing a world already hollowed out.
In many cases, yes. The baseline had already shifted dramatically.
And this isn't just abstract numbers. There's the story of Tisquantum, who we know as Squanto, the guy who helped the pilgrims. His story is sort of a tragic microcosm of this, isn't it?
It's the perfect heartbreaking example. Squanto could communicate with the pilgrims and show them how to plant corn because his entire village, the Patuxet, had been essentially wiped out by an epidemic between 1616 and 1619, just before the Mayflower arrived.
So the cleared fields they found, the seemingly available land?
It wasn't pristine. It was abandoned fields and burial grounds. He was helping them survive in the ruins of his own world. It's the widowed land embodied in one person's story.
Okay, moving beyond the sheer numbers and the tragedy, let's talk about the time depth and sophistication. Man has to push back the timeline for human arrival too, right? Challenging the old Clovis first idea.
Absolutely. For decades, the consensus was that humans arrived around 13,500 years ago, Clovis culture. But man highlights evidence, particularly the Monteverde site in Chile, which is solidly dated to at least 14,500 years ago, maybe earlier.
So people were here much, much longer.
Thousands of years longer, which means thousands more years for complex societies to develop, adapt, and crucially, engineer their environments.
In that engineering, let's talk maize, corn. It seems so basic, but man presents it as this incredible technological achievement.
It really was. You have to understand, modern corn came from this tiny, fairly unimpressive wild grass called teosinte. Transforming that into the high-yield, versatile staple crop that could feed massive populations wasn't an accident of nature.
It was deliberate.
Highly deliberate. Mm-hmm. Man calls it a feat of genetic engineering so audacious that modern scientists are still figuring out exactly how they did it over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
These weren't just farmers. They were sophisticated plant breeders, biological innovators. It was high technology for its time.
That really changes how you think about advancement. We tend to look for stone buildings or metal tools, but here, the genius was biological. And this wasn't just in Mexico, right? Other regions had different kinds of sophistication.
Oh, definitely. Look at the Andes, places like Norte Chico or Corral in Peru. Mm-hmm. You've got monumental architecture, pyramids, complex irrigation systems as old as the Egyptian pyramids.
Wow.
But get this.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have built this complex society without relying on a major grain crop initially. It was based on cotton, trade, and incredibly rich marine resources from the Pacific. It challenges our assumptions about what's necessary for civilization.
And the Maya.
Well, the Maya are famous for their calendar, their mathematics.
Yeah.
They developed the concept of zero independently. They're incredibly accurate astronomy. In many ways, more sophisticated than contemporary European systems at the time. These are parallel worlds of deep intellectual achievement.
Okay, let's shift to the land itself. This is maybe the most mind-bending part of 1491 for me. The artificial wilderness. Let's start with the Amazon. We're always told it's pristine jungle, poor soil, couldn't support large populations.
Yeah, that was the standard view. But it's been completely overturned by the discovery and understanding of Terra Proto do Indo-Amazonian dark earths.
Dark earths.
It's this incredibly fertile, black, human-made soil. They created it over centuries by adding charcoal, pottery fragments, organic waste, fish bones, you name it. It doesn't wash away like typical Amazonian soils. It actually regenerates.
And there's a lot of it.
Huge amounts.
Yeah.
Kilometers upon kilometers in some areas. The sheer scale of Terra Preta proves the Amazon wasn't empty. It was actively managed, farmed, and supported large, settled populations for millennia. That we think of as virgin jungle might actually be overgrown orchards or farm plots.
So the jungle itself is, in part, a human artifact.
In many areas, yes. or at least its current state, is a result of the absence of the humans who managed it. And we see a similar thing in North America with the forests.
The Great Eastern Forest, right, that the colonists saw.
Exactly. They described it as open, park-like, easy to travel through, not the thick, tangled woods we might imagine. Why? Because indigenous people were constantly managing it, primarily with fire.
Fire. They were burning the forest.
Controlled burns. Sophisticated pyrotechnology, as man calls it. Regular, low-intensity fires cleared out the underbrush, promoted grasses that attracted game animals like deer and bison, made travel easier, and encouraged useful nut and berry trees. It wasn't wilderness. It was a managed landscape.
And when the people disappeared because of disease?
The burning stopped. The undergrowth exploded. The forest grew thick and wild. So the very wilderness that later European settlers and, you know, romantic poets celebrated was actually a result of the demographic catastrophe. It was the ecosystem reverting, becoming less managed, less humanized.
That's incredible. And the human shaping wasn't always just, you know, subtle burning. You mentioned Cahokia earlier.
Right, Cahokia.
Yeah.
Near modern St. Louis, this was a massive city, part of the Mississippian culture. Around, say, 1100 AD, it was likely larger than London was at the time.
Bigger than London.
Yeah. Huge earthen mounds, the biggest one larger at its base than the Great Pyramid of Giza. A complex society, extensive trade networks, sophisticated agriculture. It completely shatters the lingering stereotype of North American natives as just small nomadic bands. These were city builders running complex societies.
This book is just... it's a fundamental rewrite of history. So, okay, let's try to distill this. If someone listening walks away with just a few key ideas from 1491, what should they be?
Okay, three big ones, I think.
Huh.
First, and maybe the most important, challenge the pristine myth. You really have to question the idea of untouched wilderness. What looks natural might actually be the result of past human activity, or, tragically, the cessation of human activity due to collapse.
Right. It forces you to ask, what is natural?
Exactly. And it means maybe active management, informed by past practices, is sometimes a better form of conservation than just hands-off preservation.
Okay, what's the second big theme?
Second, grasp the scale of the demographic catastrophe, the Great Dying. Realize that the Columbian Exchange wasn't just about goods and ideas. It was overwhelmingly biological, primarily disease flowing one way, losing 90-95% of a population. It's arguably the single greatest demographic disaster in human history. It puts everything that came after colonization, the development of the modern Americas, into a completely different context.
It's hard to even comprehend that scale of loss. And the third point.
Third is about indigenous agency and sophistication. We need to move past the old, frankly racist narratives of primitive peoples. Man shows Native Americans as active agents in their own history, as brilliant environmental engineers, sophisticated farmers, mathematicians, city planners, empire builders.
Yeah, restoring that complexity and ingenuity is huge.
Their achievements, like creating maize or managing vast forest ecosystems, need to be recognized as major human accomplishments, period. Not judged against a purely Eurocentric definition of advancement.
Man's writing is so vivid, too. Let's recall a few key lines that really capture these ideas. Here's one about the overall picture. Indians were here far longer than previously thought, were in greater numbers, and were so successful at imposing their will on the landscape that in 1492, Columbus set foot in a hemisphere thoroughly dominated by humankind.
Yeah, that sums it up perfectly. Not a new world. An ancient world shaped by people for millennia. History, not emptiness.
And this one on that Holmberg's mistake idea. The claim that the Amazon was an anthropological blank was as much a product of disease and subjugation as of careful observation.
Right. It highlights how that mass death just skewed everything. The observers were documenting the wreckage, not the original structure, and that flawed observation became accepted wisdom for centuries.
And one more on that incredible story of maize. The domestication of maize from a scrawny wild grass was a feat of genetic engineering so audacious that modern scientists have struggled to comprehend how it was accomplished. It was a human invention, a piece of high technology.
Love that quote. It just elevates these ancient innovators, puts them on par with inventors anywhere, demands respect for that ingenuity.
Okay, so this isn't just fascinating history. How does this radical rethinking apply to us, to you listening today? What are the real world takeaways?
Well, one big one is rethinking environmentalism and conservation. If wilderness isn't always purely natural, maybe our goal shouldn't always be just leaving it alone. Perhaps effective conservation in some ecosystems, needs active human intervention informed by these long histories of indigenous management. Think controlled burns, maybe even exploring modern versions of terra preta for sustainable agriculture.
So learning from that deep history.
Exactly. Indigenous knowledge isn't just history. It could be a blueprint for sustainable practices today.
And for anyone interested in history or just learning generally, it's a powerful lesson in critical thinking, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mann's work is Exhibit A in questioning established narratives. It trains you to ask, whose story is this? What evidence is missing? Crucially, are we looking at a system in its normal state, or are we looking at the aftermath of a trauma and mistaking that for the baseline? Are we making Holmberg's mistake somewhere else?
That's a great question to ask in many contexts. And there's even practical science here, like with the terra preta.
For sure. That offers a potential model for sustainable development, especially in tropical regions, creating incredibly fertile, long-lasting soil without massive industrial inputs. That's hugely relevant for food security and regenerative agriculture today. People are actively researching how to replicate it.
Okay, wrapping up, what was the single most surprising thing for you revisiting this book?
You know, even knowing the story, the sheer scale of that population loss, 90, 95%, just always hits me. The realization that almost the entirety of European colonization and the founding of modern nations in the Americas happened in the shadow of, and was arguably enabled by, this continent-wide biological catastrophe that was largely invisible to the colonizers themselves.
Yeah, that's profound. For me, I think what I love most is the restoration of agency. Moving the story away from passive, primitive people just waiting for history to happen to them and towards seeing these diverse, complex societies full of innovators, engineers, philosophers, people who actively shaped their world on a vast scale before disaster struck.
Well said. And that brings us to maybe the final thought to leave everyone with, the question the book raises. Given that the Americas were this thoroughly humanized landscape in 1491, managed and engineered for millennia, how does understanding that deep history of indigenous interaction change what we think we're trying to preserve or restore in the environment today?
That is a big question. What are we actually aiming for when we talk about conservation? It definitely requires looking at both history and nature with fresh eyes. Thanks so much for walking us through this paradigm-shifting book.
My pleasure. It's essential reading.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.